Okay, so we made it through the introduction. I say that was a great feat. That was tough. Or we made it through the introduction to the introduction. I'm not sure. This looks like the introduction. Okay, so I think we'll go in like we've done before. Okay, so it'll be me and Donna and Gail and then Kim and Melissa and Nancy and Nelda and Starlet. Okay, so I will go ahead and read the first paragraph. The Four Noble Truths, the Matrix of the Teaching. Introduction. In his first discourse, known as the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the discourse setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, the Buddha spoke of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, the unique middle way that avoids the dismal ends of sensual indulgence and painful ascetic practices and leads to the peace and freedom of Nibbana. The transmission of the Dhamma hinged upon insight into this interlocking set of principles. It was by comprehending these truths that his first disciples, the five monks, gained the dust-free, stainless eye of the Dhamma, the decisive breakthrough that opens the liberating path. Repeatedly during his teaching career, he brought his discourse to a climax with an exposition of the truths. Think Donna is next.
Yep. Before you go, is it possible to make the print a wee bit larger? Thank you.
Did you wanted me to read, right?
Right, yeah. Let's see, there we go.
Is that good? Or still bigger?
A little bit there. That
Okay.
will be. Thank you.
The Four Noble Truths were so central to the Buddha's exposition of the Dhamma that the compilers of the Samyutta Nikaya devoted an entire chapter to this topic, the last in the whole collection. However, the Four Truths might be seen not merely as one Buddhist doctrine among others, but more broadly as the implicit framework of the whole teaching. The Buddha's chief disciple, Sariputta, underscored the importance of this formula when he said, "Just as the footprints of all other animals of the jungle can fit into the footprint of an elephant, which is declared chief with respect to size, so whatever wholesome teachings there are can all fit into the Four Noble Truths." The classical Buddhist commentaries follow upon this suggestion by showing that the Four Noble Truths can be extracted from other teachings, even when they are not explicitly mentioned as such.
Modern exponents of Buddhism often assume that the Four Noble Truths are an elementary teaching intended for newcomers to the Dhamma. But the Buddha himself did not treat them in such a way. Rather, he saw them as suitable only for those whose minds were ripe enough to understand them clearly and directly. He would usually begin a discourse to inquirers with a talk on generosity and morality, virtues that any person of moral convictions could appreciate. From there, he would proceed to explain the workings of karma and the realms of rebirth to which different courses of action lead. Then, having described the joys of the heavens, he would speak about the faults in the pursuit of sensual pleasures and the benefits of renunciation, thereby instilling in his audience respect for the kind of contemplative life that he himself had adopted. It was only at this point, when he knew that the minds of his listeners were sufficiently open, trusting, and free from obstructions, that he would reveal the Four Noble Truths, which the texts describe as, quote, the special Dhamma teaching of the Buddhas, unquote. And I don't know how to pronounce that.
The Four Noble Truths might also be seen as the underlying blueprint of the Samyutta Nikaya, as explained in the general introduction. The other major chapters of this collection can then be seen as elaboration of the individual truths. It might then be significant that the entire Samyutta ends with the chapter on the Four Noble Truths, highlighting this teaching as the crown jewel of this major compilation.
Sorry, I couldn't find it. According to 1.10, the things that Buddha directly knew were many, like the leaves in a forest grove, but the things he expounded were few, like the leaves he took up in his hand. These few things were suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. The reason he did not disclose all the things he had seen was because those things do not bring true benefits. The reason he repeatedly expounded the Four Noble Truths was because these principles are beneficial and lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to sensation, to peace, and to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana.
Nancy, I think it's you. You're muted still.
I'm sorry. The first discourse, the Dhammacapavattana Sutta, provides formal explanations of the Four Noble Truths. Most of these explanations are also included in 1.4, which differs from the first discourse only by offering a crisper definition of the First Noble Truth. In the first discourse, the Buddha enumerates eight kinds of dukkha. The first four, birth, old age, sickness, and death, can be grouped under the heading of a physiological suffering. The next three are union with the unpleasant, separation from the pleasant, and not getting what one wants, which can be comprised under the heading of psychological suffering. And the last is the five clinging aggregates, which might be described as ontological or existential suffering. Omitting the detailed manifestations of dukkha mentioned in the first discourse, text 1.4 defines the first truth simply as the five clinging aggregates, which in the first discourse are said to encapsulate the truth of suffering in brief. Samhitina.
I would like to ask a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What is dukkha?
Well, you know, there's lots of different ways that I've heard it translated. And most commonly, I think it's translated as suffering. There are eight kinds of suffering. But there's also a translation that implies out of true or out of kilter. It's described as when a wheel is set on an axle and it's not set true. And so the wheel continually jerks. And it's not, and that's described as being, or that's one explanation of what dukkha is. It's another explanation that I've heard is, oh, I can't remember the term exactly, but dissatisfaction. This dissatisfaction that is present in human life. Does that all make sense?
Very much so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about this particular paragraph.
Was grasping a word you were thinking of?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
No.
I don't know what the five clinging aggregates are. Maybe we just have to wait and read further.
Here we go.
Oh, here, great.
I was gonna give the answer. The Pali word dukkha, common for all four truths, calls for some explanation necessary to avoid misunderstanding. As a matter of convenience, most translators render this word as suffering, and I follow their precedent. This rendering, however, can lead to the misunderstanding that the Buddha holds that all existence is perpetual, rife with pain and misery. That is not the case at all, for which reason some translators prefer to leave dukkha untranslated. In certain contexts, especially in relation to feeling, dukkha does mean pain and suffering, and this seems to have been the original usage of the word. However, the Buddha drew this word out from its original context and gave it a deeper significance, using it to highlight the inescapably flawed, deficient, and unsatisfactory nature of sentient existence.
Mommy. From this perspective, not only painful experience, but all experience within the conditioned world is inherently defective. Life, according to the Nikayas, certainly contains abundant opportunities for joy and happiness, even occasions of rapture and bliss. The popular Mangala Sutta enumerates 38 blessings among them such mundane sources of happiness as supporting one's parents, maintaining a family, helping friends and relatives, working at an honest occupation, and engaging in righteous deeds. All these blessings, however, are unstable and subject to change. Every factor of being, every facet of experience, when looked at closely, turns out to be impermanent and therefore unreliable, unable to provide complete satisfaction. It is this sense of deficiency or lack that the word dukkha is intended to suggest. Ultimate release from dukkha can only be found in that which lies beyond the sphere of transience and mortality, that is, in nirvana, the unconditioned state free from birth, decay, and death.
Wow, that paragraph too, I have a lot of question about. I mean, I keep thinking about enjoying these blessings, you know, one of the 38 blessings. Actually, I was thinking, because I'm kind of hungry, I was thinking about the blessing of eating, the blessing of food, and thinking, yeah, if you want it to be, if I have in my mind that it's going to last forever, then yeah, that there's dissatisfaction associated with it. But if I don't, if I know that, like when I look at a flower, this is only going to last so long, then I feel like I can fully enjoy something and not experience a deficiency, a sense of deficiency. If I expect things to last forever, then yeah, I experience a sense of lack when they don't. I don't know.
If we expect them also to be perfect every time we encounter an experience, and somehow as we were reading this paragraph, my neural path went to Peg talking about, was it 108 vows that you do for a certain period of time? And so I got really curious about that and came across a YouTube video about linking the 108 vows to gratitude. And there are actually 108 things with each vow that you are grateful for. And I have to tell you, some of those, it's like, for not that this is one of them, but the first vow you take in this list that they created is, I am grateful for my parents. Well, we know that our parents were imperfect and there were moments we really didn't like them or what they did, but there's something you can find to be grateful for instead of yearning for what wasn't there or clinging to what is past. And so that's what came up for me in this paragraph about, for me, this 38 blessings, I see more as 38 ways to be grateful, because I also saw another little video from neuroscientists that said the two absolutely necessary and only necessary components for happiness are gratitude and agency. If you have gratitude and a sense of agency, even in the most horrible situation, if your agency is to accept the moment as it is, that brings peace and joy. I just find all of that fascinating, that there is a way to hold even the most horrible moment you can imagine as a blessing, I guess, using the words in this book. That's what came up for me.
To me, it actually brought out the one thing I really don't like. And that is All these blessings, however, are unstable and subject to change. Ultimate release from dukkha can only be found in that which lies beyond the sphere of transience and mortality. And what I mean by that is that what I don't like is I want stability. And that's what you cannot have in this life. And what, to my understanding, what it, in this paragraph is saying is that the reason for dukkha is because we do not have stability. Because we may be very happy to be supporting one's parents, but they will come when they're going to die. That they will come when they are going to become older and maybe get sick and maybe. So is it a blessing to take care of them? Yes. Are you always going to be taking care of them? No. And you don't know the different circumstances that are going to be happening there. Like you were mentioning, Nelda, just because a parent may get sick or may die, does that take away the happiness that was there or the love that was there? No, it doesn't. But it's just that not knowing what's going to happen next because everything is always changing. And I hate that. I wish things were stable and that I knew what was going to happen next. So I completely understand this definition of dukkha as a source of suffering and feeling that lack. Because when you are like in a perfect moment, you will want that to stay forever. That doesn't happen. The same for something that is bad. And in that case, thank goodness that it will change. But yeah, transience and mortality.
So Donna has put something in a little note in chat. Does satisfaction need to be complete? So Donna, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, as I was looking at the paragraph, it seems like the pain is, you know, unable to provide complete satisfaction. But if, you know, every moment is just that moment, a temporary moment until the next moment comes. So the satisfaction, how can you even define complete, like what would be complete satisfaction? The word complete seems to me that it would be more of permanent, yeah, I don't know, complete reminds me of permanence, like complete satisfaction. But we don't have permanence, so you're not going to get complete satisfaction. And isn't that okay? Because all you have is that moment and take that fleeting moment of satisfaction. I think to, as a way of, and I do love this that it says, the sphere of transience and mortality, that is nirvana. So until that moment of nirvana, maybe you have little moments. Oh, this is just coming to me now. If each moment is an individual moment, could you not have nirvana between each moment, because it's a death of the last moment, just that slight little sliver when the past moment switches into the present. You know, does that make sense at all? I don't know, that just popped in my head.
Yeah,
May I respond to your use of the word, or his use of the word complete satisfaction, Donna?
Say that again?
May I respond to
oh, yeah, sure.
your exploration of that? As I was reading that sentence, I thought of the myriad of times, and Kim has his hand up. So the myriad of times in my life when I thought, oh, this is it. This is the perfect house. This is my ideal car. This is the perfect relationship. All delusion. I think that was what the author was pointing to, that every factor being in every experience, when we really look at it closely, we are superimposing upon it an expectation, a false image that over time will prove unsatisfactory in some ways because we've created this delusion around it. That's how I read it. And so I don't know that complete satisfaction in any experience is possible unless, as you were saying, we see the with wisdom, the truth of what is in that moment without all the stories we wrap around it, including the yearning or the aversion to whatever comes up in it.
This whole subject of suffering and gratitude, it makes me think of how I went through a period of time when I was feeling depressed and a little out of control over events I felt in my life. And I really didn't see anything to be grateful for. And then I began to write and to journal every night. I had to find at least 5 things to be grateful for. And so I had to start very small. And now that we're having this discussion, Donna, I can see that the first thing I might think of during that period of time was the air conditioning's blowing on my face. It feels good. I'm grateful for that. You know, I have a comfortable bed I'm in right now. I feel grateful for that. And these things are happening in the moment that you're in. You know, I had no expectation of air conditioning or bed, or maybe in the background I did, Nelda. But in that moment, I could find something very, very small, you know. And I was in such a state that I couldn't see past that. So I couldn't say, oh, the air conditioning's working. I have such a wonderful life. Aren't I lucky? You know, it was just purely in that moment. That's what I was grateful for. And it began to build. So I had to start small. And the other thing in what we read, I don't know if I heard it right, but did I hear that the Buddha did not start with the Four Noble Truths when new people came? He felt that that was just something too broad, too deep, too esoteric, maybe, for people to really get, you know?
Too scary?
Right. That was, yeah, that was the explanation at the beginning, that he didn't start with that he started with morality and generosity.
Yes. Yes. And that's so interesting, because when I first ran into the Four Noble Truths, my first gut reaction was resistance. It was sort of like, well, not everything's that bad, you know. But that's because I was seeing the surface of it, not, you know, kind of finally realizing that in my day-to-day perspective, I was causing suffering. Not that the world is filled with suffering, but my vision of the world actually causes lots and lots of unnecessary suffering. So anyway, those things.
Great. Well, I think it's time to move on, unless somebody else has something particular they wanted to add about this.
I would like to add something.
Mm-hmm.
If life is like we see with the seasons, you have birth, you have, you know, you have the summer, you have spring, but then you're going to have the decay with fall and winter. You're going to have death. But then it comes back, another birth, another, you know, rebirth, and another. Life is going to continue. There's always going to be that evolution in life as we live every day on everything that we do. So my point is that thing that you were telling before, that, well, I don't know if that's what you were referring to, but about the food always being there, and that you could, if it wasn't there all the time, you could really enjoy it because it was fleeting and you knew it was not going to be there. So basically with life, what makes us be able to appreciate the good, to truly appreciate that, is also because it's just going to last for a very, very small moment. Either if it's good or if it's bad, that's what makes you appreciate life, that is ephemeral. But then when I look at this with the Buddha, in this explanation of dukkha and the Four Noble Truths, I kind of feel like it's looking at life from a different perspective by saying, I see you, life, and you are going from birth to death and everything in between. So you're going to give me moments of happiness, moments of suffering, moments of in between. But you're always going to be moving. And I'm always going to be losing something. I'm always going to be gaining something. But it's kind of looking life from a side and seeing it and saying, I don't want to play that game. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's a way of, it feels to me like it's a way of walking through life without being, going through the ups and downs, or not letting the ups and downs of life getting to you. And this may be an oversimplification, but that's just what I thought.
Yeah, that really resonates for me, that it's an ongoing question for me, though, whether you have to have pain to enjoy pleasure. I'm not sure about that. I try to think about my own experience, and I've had both pleasure and pain, so I can't, or pleasure and the cessation of pleasure. So I can't say that I've never experienced one or the other. And so I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I love I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's it's the an answer. Ongoing,
yeah,
an ongoing it's, question for me.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that it's, you know, and of course we're taught this, it's the clinging and the pushing away of whatever is happening in the moment that seems to be the root of things. That and the fact that we don't know what we really are, I guess. But yeah, so I can see, you know, maybe gradually letting go of wanting to grab onto the moment or push the moment away. You know, how do you do that? That's the real koan, you know.
And may I add to Starlet, I so get this existential angst. I so get it, Starlet. I hear you. And I keep reminding myself the story of the young boy who was conscripted into this army, and part of what they were required to do was take this horribly heavy rifle, almost, you know, his weight, and march for miles and miles and miles. And carry that and do that every day. That was his existence, to do that every day as a soldier. And he came back to his commander and said, I can't do this. You know, just lock me up now, kill me now, whatever. I can't do this. I can't carry what's required in my life, essentially, he was saying. And the and his leader said to him, it's not the weight of the rifle, it's how you carry it. And so each day the boy practiced carrying the rifle differently. And by the end of a period, he was able to, you know, outpace everyone and carry it lightly. And I keep reminding myself in those moments when I say, really, do I really, in a cost-benefit analysis, do I really want a whole life the way I'm suggesting that I do? I just keep saying, maybe you just haven't learned how to carry the rifle, Nelda. So,
that's a great...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said that's a great analogy.
I also wanted to say that this ultimate release from dukkha also seems like a craving for certainty, a craving for sureness and sameness and stability. I mean, if the goal of this is to get to Nibbana, it feels like that's just another way to be sure to me. A Nibbana where nothing ever changes, because you're free from all change, birth, death, and decay. So that seems a little...
I think that's a beautiful question, is what would the opposite be to dukkha? That's what you're asking, right?
No, I don't know that I'm asking that.
Or you're proposing that what it would be, the opposite of dukkha?
I guess I'm proposing, what is the, well, no.
Well, if you were released of all dukkha, what would it be like?
No, I wasn't saying that. I was saying that this, well, Nibbana, it would be Nibbana. If you didn't have any dukkha, it would be Nibbana. And it would, I mean, from what I can tell, or the feeling that I get from the sentence there, ultimate release from dukkha, lies beyond the fear of transience. So there's something that's not transient, which means it's stable, which seems like what we were saying we were trying to not be attached to in the beginning.
But if it's just stable, I think that it's a transient condition still. It's just free from birth, decay, and death. It doesn't mean you're not still going places and doing things, as it were. It just means, I mean, because if it was just sitting in a lovely, unconditional state, I wouldn't want to go there. I mean, I would want to keep going and learning and seeing and doing, but without the baggage of death and decay and birth and that kind of thing. I would think that there's a state that maybe we don't really know much about, but it, to me, it can't, I mean, it could be, and I'll be disappointed, but it can't be just a place, you know, where nothing happens. That's just terrible to me. Yeah. It's like in the Christian tradition when, you know, you go to heaven and you get to be with all the angels and spend your day singing horrible hymns. Why would you want to do that? There's got to be something beyond that.
So you get to do what you want to do, which for me is God's gardener and dancer. You know, I would dance all day and buy flowers all day, and that to me would be heaven. That's my picture.
Yes. I mean, yes, that I think that too. But then if you were doing that for all eternity, would you still be wanting it 100,000 years from now? You know,
I think it'd be awesome.
Yeah, it can't be. I'm not arguing with you. I agree with you.
There's no feeling so good on earth as when that headache finally goes away. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have that if you were just sitting on a cloud singing all day long. You wouldn't have had meeting the challenge and succeeding. And I'm sure there's a lot more examples when your child is sick and then isn't sick anymore. Wow, that's the greatest joy on earth. So exactly. That's what I would think, yeah.
Donna's got some great comments in the comment in the chat box.
I think Nibbana is completely unstable. Well, it's unconditioned, is what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. Unconditioned feels more permanent. The unconditioned state, that is Nibbana. The unconditioned state.
I like that idea.
I disagree. Pain does exist.
Okay, well, what do you guys think about? Let's move on. This has been
because all the answers are going to be in the next paragraph, right?
Maybe so, just like the Dukkha question. Okay, I guess it's my turn. The German monk Nanyatikola, in his classic The Word of the Buddha, eloquently captures the meaning of dukkha when he writes, "The term suffering, dukkha, in the First Noble Truth refers therefore not merely to painful bodily and mental sensations due to unpleasant impressions, but it comprises in addition everything productive of suffering or liable to it. The truth of suffering teaches that owing to the universal law of impermanence, even high and sublime states of happiness are subject to change and destruction, and that all states of existence are therefore unsatisfactory. Let me read that again. Even high and sublime states of happiness are subject to change and destruction, and that all states of existence are therefore unsatisfactory, without exception, carrying in themselves the seeds of suffering."
Should we continue, or do we want to take that all in? That's quite a bit to take in.
You know, it's making me think of something that Flint has often said. This is pointing to something that isn't free of suffering. It's freedom within any suffering. And so I ask myself, and have been asking myself, the big question, which is, what is it that doesn't change. In my own direct experience, what is it that never changes? And I think that's where the peace lies, because there's something that is able to go through all experience, and it's not even a thing. It's a way of flowing with, you know, people call it consciousness or awareness, or I don't know, you know, you can come up with all kinds of words because the words don't do it. But I came to one morning, I came to the idea that it was, oh, experiencing. That's what I am. There's always been experiencing. Experiencing is all, there's no person experiencing. There's just experiencing. And for some reason that made me very happy, and I didn't feel like I needed to have it be good experiencing or bad experiencing. It just seemed kind of an idea which took hold of me. So, yeah, I don't think the idea is to get rid of suffering or to enter a heavenly state where everything is lovely, because what they're saying here is that no state is going to be ultimately satisfactory. So what is beyond states? And that's what the Buddhist teachings are ultimately trying to point us to. And anyway, that's, you know, all of some of the thoughts that were in my head right now.
I like what you said about experiencing. I think the only thing I can think of for me that's close to what you were just saying is when I'm writing, because I'm not thinking. I can't say I'm thinking. I'm just putting words down and then go back and see what they say later. Just the experience of writing is amazing to me. And you know, I could write Dick and Jane and it wouldn't make any difference to me. Yeah, I really like what you said. Thank you.
So all states of existence. So all states of existence. I guess my question with that is there anything else?
Yep. Well, they all end. So of course they carry in them. This made perfect sense. All states of existence end and therefore carry within them the seed of suffering. You know, children grow, parents die, we get ill, the merry-go-round ride ends and you don't have another ticket. You know, there's just, it all ends. And so it's just whether or not you know, what do you feed? Do you feed the seed of dissatisfaction and create suffering, or do you feed another seed?
Yeah, because if you're on that merry-go-round and you're so worried about when it's going to stop, you're not experiencing being on the merry-go-round. So you're not enjoying it. It's not, or not enjoying it if you're getting dizzy, you're not being present, right? You're not being there. If you're always worried about when it's going to start or when it's going to stop. I think that might be something.
I feel that this is more about ending it from the point of view of reincarnation. If we believe that we're going to reincarnate again, and we're going to be going through this whole process all over again and again and again and again, I think that Nibbana means a way of stopping that. So I don't think Nibbana is something that we would experience while we're alive, but it would be what it will stop us from having to reincarnate again. So we would have achieved, hopefully, we would have become wise enough, knowledgeable, I don't know, whatever state that we would achieve in order to be able to reach Nirvana. But I don't think Nirvana is a place where nothing would happen. I think it's a place where we could be with our loved ones because they wouldn't die. They wouldn't get sick again, that we would be able to enjoy things because they would be permanent, but not permanent like being a statue that nothing gets done. But I don't really know what Nirvana could be. But I hope it's a place where there is no pain.
I like what Donna just said. There's always satisfaction in the moment.
Depending.
I think that's what she said.
Yeah, we spend our time trying to get someplace. There's really no place to get. this is actually it.
Speaking of getting somewhere, I just had a horrible observation. It's not just the next paragraph, but there's footnotes too that we haven't Yeah.
For me, thank goodness for Isaac Asimov, because he taught me to read footnotes. Always. Oh my goodness, and these are necessary footnotes.
Oh my gosh, should we be running back and forth between these?
I guess so.
No, I don't know. I've found that often it's easier to go back to the footnotes after you've read it, because otherwise you're yeah. bouncing. And
yeah, really.
If it's at the bottom of the page, hopefully, not at the end of this chapter, then you still know what you read, and so you can understand.
Oh, so it isn't at the bottom of the page, it is at the end of the chapter.
I don't know who invented that, but they should be removed.
But with this technology, just by clicking on the number, it takes you right there. What is the footnote this paragraph?
Without the seeds of suffering, looks like a five. Yeah.
Where he got it.
Quoting where he says that. Where this person from Germany, the German monk, Nayat. Okay, I'm going to learn to say it. Nyanatiloka. Nyanatiloka. Nyanatiloka.
Oh, there it is. Nyanatiloka.
Okay. Well, I vote we go on and keep reading.
I think we could check on the footnotes as we get to them, since technology has caught up with my irritation. I like that.
Whose turn is it?
Is it Donna?
I think it's Donna.
Yeah, it's my turn. I thought we all wanted to reflect. The first noble truth gains further traction from the connection between dukkha and samsara, the round of repeated birth and death. Again, Nyakala Loka astutely points to this connection. Samsara is the unbroken sequence of the fivefold Kandaha combinations, the five aggregates, which constantly changing from moment to moment,
follow continually one upon the other through inconceivable periods of time. Of this samsara, a single lifetime constitutes only a tiny fraction. Hence, to be able to comprehend the first noble truth, one must let one's gaze rest upon the samsara, upon the frightful sequence of rebirths, and not merely upon one single lifetime, which of course may sometimes be not very painful.
Well, wow, I hadn't considered that.
The origin of dukkha in the analysis of the four truths is said to be tanha, a word translated as craving, but which literally means thirst, a blind thirst for pleasure, existence, and even annihilation that operates in the minds of all unenlightened beings. Oh, Donna, did you want to read that other paragraph again before we started? This one?
Yeah, I'd like to, I'm interested in reading this little passage again, especially where, let me see. Okay. Samsara is the unbroken sequence of the fivefold Kandaha combinations, the five aggregates, which constantly changing from moment to moment, follow continually one upon the other through inconceivable periods of time. Of this samsara, a single lifetime constitutes only a tiny fraction. Hence, to be able to comprehend the first noble truth, one must let one's gaze rest upon the samsara, upon this frightful sequence of rebirth, and not merely upon one single lifetime, which of course may sometimes may not be very painful. I really love that. At first when I was reading and I thought that I had to read it again a second time, because the first time I'm thinking, because the number was there, I think it's, was it four or five? And I was linking that with lifetimes, thinking, oh, it's just four or five lifetimes. But then I don't believe that's what it says, but it's quite interesting that it says, so in a single lifetime, there may not, it may not be very painful. That's very, very interesting to me. It's almost like, when I think of that, I think of, so human life is kind of like, if you think of the various, you know, birth, baby, and then I get, I'll just say the little bits, you know, baby, then a kid, I guess, and then a teenager, then an adult, then a, you know, older adult, then a senior. Those are like human lifetimes, and they're, you know, various parts of those human lifetimes may not be very painful, but a part of it may be painful, right?
So it's almost like, in my mind, this fascinates me that we're like we're mirroring the larger, you know, like so the reincarnated lives. So this single life is a mirror of the larger life of multi reincarnations. And I think almost everything in the universe is kind of like that. I don't know why I'm saying this, but there's this macro and micro that it, and I just feel like it's, and I think there's mathematics in there too, that the smaller, you know, when you go smaller and smaller, it's just small, but it's still the same as the large. If that is making sense at all. I don't know. That's in my mind how I see it all.
Yeah, you're talking you're about accurate. Fractals.
Yeah. Or think of a mosquito. A mosquito is as full and complete a life as a human life. It's just shorter by the way we measure it, but it's a full life, an ant's life. That's what I heard you saying. And we are incarnations. If we all started from the Big Bang, we're incarnations of a star. We all came of the earth. We are incarnations of what came before us. Not only in terms of karmic, you know, the ancient twisted karma that the generations have passed down, but even physically.
It creates a sense of urgency, this paragraph. For me, it's, you know, just a sense of a kind of mystery in a way, too, and wonder. And then a sense of the importance of really, really finding out the truth of what we are and what this experience is. And so, you know, that's why I started spiritual work. And, yeah, it's not just it's for me, it's almost a it's an encouragement to keep asking questions and to do inquiry and to get to I guess you could say the bottom of this, you know, as you guys are pointing out, for if everything's connected, for the entire whole, you know, even my little understanding may contribute to this whole in some way, you know.
Is it possible to think of it as like a jigsaw puzzle? And every lifetime is one piece, but you can't see the whole picture until you get all the pieces put together.
I like that.
Yeah. I like it.
What's confusing me is the last phrase, the not merely upon one single lifetime, which of course may sometimes not be very painful. It's almost like he's saying, if it's not painful enough, it's not worth anything. You're not getting anything out of it.
Oh, that's not how I understood it. I took it from the point of view that if it's not very painful, you had a good life. So you're not going to try to get out of reincarnation because you're going to want to stop being reincarnated over and over if you're having a hard time. But if you're not really suffering, then there's nothing wrong with life. The problem is when suffering is involved. At least that's how I understood it. But I would like to ask, what were the five aggregates?
That's a question for me too. I don't know the five aggregates. Maybe Kim will look up five aggregates for us.
I
What are
just
the five?
Googled. Thank
Yeah,
you,
what are the five
Kim. I
aggregates?
don't think you want to know.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, the skandhas. So it's the skandhas, the five aggregates. Matter, sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness.
You know, we say form rather than matter in the
Right.
Heart Sutra.
Right.
Right.
Oh, here.
Form, the physical aspect, feeling the physical.
Looks like it's all of the experience of being informed kind of summed up. Yeah. Thinking, feeling, perceiving.
That's interesting that they say consciousness is not self. I wouldn't call that, I wouldn't call not self one of the five skandhas.
I agree.
Well, it's not small self. Is it small s?
Well, that's what we get from looking on Google.
Yeah, because we think we're that self. There's something more fundamental, apparently.
Okay. Heaps.
I think I made a wrong question because I am so much more confused now.
Yeah, really.
We want to understand everything, don't we?
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to kind of immerse yourself in the teaching and then let it percolate.
Then I'm
That
gonna
is so true.
percolate because, oh my goodness, baby steps.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
going to
true.
suggest we come to a stopping point and let things percolate.
Yeah, this looks like a good place to do that. The
I
origin of
agree.
I don't know if you all knew, but when you see the dotted line, that's a place that a lot of people highlighted.
Right.
Right.
So I'll bookmark this.
Because if we've been talking, this has inspired so many in-depth conversation today. Imagine now, if we know that that's beginning of that paragraph is supposed to be one that we're going to be talking about.
Really? Well, thank you all very much.
Thank
And
you.
Thank you.
thank you, Anne and Kim, for doing this. Really lovely.
This was really good.
Continue on Monday
Yeah.
next. Thank you.
Good night.
Good
Bye.
night.